Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Martin Luther King Jr., the ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy. Coming up on today's program, Kevin Donaher from Global Exchange is going to be here talking about why introducing folks to different cultures drives social and economic justice. But first,
what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The liberal shadow knows.
Indeed. Yeah. Oh, my. Believe it or not, there are a bunch of people excited about gasoline prices. They include Jack Cafferty, who exploded. CNN's Jack Cafferty exploded. I hope gas prices go as high as they have to get the rest of these morons off the road, these big Hummers, and March 25th on the money. That written by Dan Gaynor, the executive director of the Free Market Project over at freemarketproject.org, their website. Dan Gaynor's on the program with us. Hey, Dan.
It's a pleasure to be back. How are you doing today?
Great. Great to have you here. The RNC, I just got this news release, I mean, literally 20 minutes ago, an email. RNC, the Republican National Committee today unveiled a new web ad entitled Democrats Pump Up the Price, highlighting Democrats' support for higher gas prices. This at the same time that up at the top of Think Progress, Fox News, Al Gore's new global warming movie, Could It Destroy Our Economy? They had Steve Forbes on saying that the economy is going to be destroyed by Al Gore's movie. And then the Competitive Enterprise Institute coming out asking the ever provocative question.
Carbon dioxide. They call it pollution. We call it life.
Carbon dioxide is good for you. It's wonderful stuff. And you guys are out there doing the talk show circuit talking about how the Democrats want high gas prices. But isn't this really about getting high profits for big oil and leaving a devastated planet to our grandchildren?
Well, of course it's not, but that's the media theme as well. I mean, it's bad because we're pretty open about criticizing anybody who said this. It's Democrats, it's media people, it's a lot of environmental groups that they think that high gas prices are good because somehow, magically, we're all going to get out of our cars, either walk or bike to work, even if you got a 45-minute commute. Somehow you're going to, you know, everything's going to be come up roses, and that's just not going to happen. So for them to hope that people have high gas prices, and ordinary people who are listening right now, they're the ones who get stuck by it.
Dan Gaynor, what do you think caused us to make the transition from horses as a form of transportation to automobiles?
Technological advance, convenience, better way of doing things.
Now, couldn't all those things be said of a new and alternative forms of energy and transportation?
If we have one, yes, absolutely. Right now, we don't. Right now, certainly some people are trying, you know, the Prius or something like that, the hybrid technology, and that seems to be gradually working. And if it takes hold and is cheaper for people and works better, then people will do it.
Why, you know, you guys are spending a lot of time and a lot of money, and I'm assuming that some of it at least is coming from the oil companies, correct me if I'm wrong, over at freemarketproject.org.
We've just changed our name. In between last time and this time, we're now Business and Media Institute, just because it's easier for people to understand. So it's businessandmedia.org.
Okay.
We get less than one-half of 1% of money from oil companies.
Okay.
So we're not that big of an organization. So
you're driven by ideology, Dan.
Yeah, actually we are. I'm a
Korean. So what is your ideology?
My ideology is to make sure that both sides of issues get covered fairly, that media do not unfairly beat up on business, that we push the whole idea of free enterprise.
Well, the last time I looked, pretty much everybody who's developing alternative energy sources to fossil fuels was doing it through a corporate form.
And that's fine. And for instance, BP, which is actually one of the big energy companies, they used to call themselves an oil company. Now they're an energy company.
Well, it's British Petroleum,
corporate name. They're one of the big supporters and investors in solar power and nuclear power. what's interesting is, you know, I don't have any problem with them doing that because they see it as a business opportunity. If they want to do that, great. But if companies don't want to do it, also great. Because until such time as the market says, we have a new technology, whether it's hydrogen fuel or whether it's, you know, somehow magically solar power cars or something, you know, like that that I can't even envision, then right now what works is oil power.
Dan, are you of the opinion that we should just wait and see what the consequences of our current behavior are in terms of the potential?
You need to be more specific.
With regard to the possibility that global warming is going to kill more people than died in for example, Hurricanes Katrina and Rita.
Well, I mean, if you're saying we should go out and spend hundreds of billions of dollars, which is what the
About what we've spent so far in Iraq.
Well, I was going to say, which is the estimate for how much it would cost just to sign on to the Kyoto Treaty.
Right.
And the Kyoto Treaty, under most estimations, including, you know, a lot of the people on the left, don't think the Kyoto Treaty would really have much impact. So if you're saying the Kyoto Treaty doesn't...
But let's not dance around this, and let's not BS our listeners here, Dan. Just, let's cut right down to it. Is your ideology, your philosophy, your thinking that we should simply wait and see what the consequences are going to be if the result of doing something proactive is that it might diminish corporate profits?
No, if you're talking about doing something proactive, which is pretty funny, proactive that would devastate our economy and put millions of people out of work, you'd better have a really...
I'm talking about something proactive to prevent the destruction of the world in which we live, the biosphere, making our environment hostile to human life.
Scientists don't agree on that point. And if scientists don't agree on that point, then what you're talking about doing is devastating the United States economy and ruining the lives of millions of Americans on something that you don't know and that 30 years ago they were telling us the exact opposite of.
So let me ask you a question, Dan Gaynor. If I gave you a beverage and I said, you know, half the scientists who look at this, and we know, by the way, I'm sure you'll agree with me, that it's not half the scientists say there's no global warming. It's like less than 1% of anybody. And for that matter, there's to the best of my knowledge, never been in a peer-reviewed publication an article in the last decade that has said that there ain't no such thing as global warming.
Actually, for the record, so we get this correct, the scientists who are on the skeptical side, they all agree that there's been a warming of a little bit more than a degree.
Just for the purpose of questioning, if I gave you a beverage and I said, you know, half the scientists say this will kill you, half of them say it won't, so the scientists don't agree on it, would you drink it?
If I was very thirsty, I would. If I was dying in the desert of thirst, of course I would.
So you suggest that we are dying in the desert the only alternative is to destroy the desert?
If the only alternative is, and let's use it, again, the Kyoto Treaty just as an example, if that doesn't even begin to solve what the left considers to be the problem and it would devastate our economy, then you're talking about somebody like Ross Gelsbank, because I was on Hannity and Combs the other night debating him, and he is of the opinion that we need to cut fossil fuel emissions by 70%. Now, 70%, if just cutting them 7% below their 1990 levels would cost millions of jobs and hundreds of billions of dollars a year, what is 70% going to do?
Dan Gaynor, really believe that the American people are so stupid that they can't figure out a way to make money off alternative energy sources?
Right now they haven't. If they could, do you think ExxonMobil, the biggest company in the United States, would not be dumping money hand over fist into alternative energy if they thought they could make money at it?
Not if they have all this oil. I mean, they have a real sweetheart deal right now. You know, they got legislation passed in the last couple of years of the Clinton administration when the Republicans took over the control of the House and Senate that says that any time the price of oil goes above $50 a barrel, all the oil under the ground on public lands in the United States that they have leases to pump, they get for free. They're getting it for free right now. Yeah, I don't think that they would have any interest in investing in anything else. They're getting free oil.
They have the distribution network. If they could come up with something that was cheaper and would not put them in the firing line of either the left or Congress or whatever, of course they'd pursue it if they could make money at it. See, that's all. You know, the great thing about capitalism is if people can make money at it, you know, some sort of other solution, then why would they continue with doing something?
People can make money selling heroin, too. I mean, there's a point at which we as a society say making money isn't the highest goal. Having a decent world in which to live is the highest goal.
But see, again, having a decent world to live, people.
I mean, you've got George W. Bush saying oil is addictive like heroin.
Since 1900, you know, the average life expectancy for Americans has virtually doubled. We live vastly better because of our energy supply.
You know, you jump off the top of the Empire State Building and you're going to have a wonderful, thrilling experience for a minute.
So you're saying for 100 years, or actually 100 plus years, we've been jumping off the Empire State Building?
Yes, I would say in geologic terms, 100 years is less than the amount of time it would take you to exhale as you're jumping off the top of the Empire State Building. Dan Gaynor, you want to stick around and talk to some of our listeners?
Absolutely.
Okay, we're talking with Dan Gaynor. He's the executive director of the Free Market Project in the Business and Media, what you call it. You can tell us again when we come back, businessandmedia.org, the website. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Our number, 866-440-8466. If you'd like to talk to Dan, we'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It really doesn't matter what anyone thinks. We just keep guzzling. Now we're on the brink. Who will get the oil? We don't want to be last. Where are we headed? We're just repeating the past. Making war just to keep the peace. Well, I just don't get it. Can you explain it to me?
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman radio program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. You get the latest iPods and all things Macintosh from Small Dog Electronics. We're talking with Dan Gaynor. He's with the Business and Media Institute, their website, businessandmedia.org, the Republicans and conservatives and business community in a full-court press here now to convince you that carbon dioxide is good for you, to quote the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and that the Democrats want to raise gasoline prices. The RNC has a new web ad out this morning, and Dan out doing the media yesterday debating Ross Gelbspan. Dan, a little disingenuous. Rob Gelbspan didn't call for a 70% reduction in the use of oil and coal.
No,
he quoted a 1995 panel of 2,000 of the world's leading climate scientists who, in a consensus statement published in a peer-reviewed journal, said that without a 70%, well, here's the quote. In 1995, a panel of the world's leading climate scientists declared that unless humanity cuts its use of coal and oil by 70% toward the end of this century, the world will suffer significant disruptions from global warming toward the end of the century. Now, that was 10 years ago, and it looks like maybe it's here. Why sacrifice the lives of people for corporate profit, Dan Gaynor?
We're not sacrificing the lives of people for anything.
Scientists, what about those people who died in New Orleans?
What about the people who died in New Orleans?
What about the people who are dying from famine across Africa? What about the people who are being displaced from their Eskimo, their Inuit communities on the Arctic Circle right now? What about the polar bears who are, well, let's keep it to human beings. What about the island out in the Pacific that's drowning? They're suing the United States for not participating.
First of all, New Orleans has nothing to do with global warming or climate change. No one says it except for the most extreme people, like, again, Ross Gelbspan.
You don't think that
Andrew Revkin, who Ross Gelbspan says is the one reporter in the entire country that he thinks does a good job. Even Andrew Revkin from the New York Times has come out and said, no, scientists don't believe that any sort of extreme weather can be laid at the foot of climate change or global warming.
No one particular storm can be laid at the foot of global climate change. You are using the natural tendency of scientists to be absolutely accurate and split hairs to divert attention away from the real issue here, which is the fact that you guys are on the side of let's kill the earth, make the profits, line our pockets, and just say screw you to our children. We don't give a damn what kind of world we're leaving you to. We're going to make our money, and we're going to live high while we can.
That's silly. And you know it
is. It's not silly. It's criminal and it's morally indefensible what you're doing, Dan Gehner.
No, because of course it's morally defensible because the same scientists who are out there now telling this have been telling us for 110 years that the climate's changing. They just can't even decide which direction. In the 70s, they were telling us about an ice age. In the middle of the last century, they're telling us about warming. And at the beginning of the last century, they were telling about another ice age. Every time the temperature changes, even the slightest bit, you know, you've got the alarmists who run out and say it's the end of the world. Well, the last time I checked, the global temperature has changed repeatedly throughout history. And in fact, before the mini ice age or little ice age, we had it around 1850. Before that, people used to live quite productively on Greenland when it was green. Now it's ice covered.
So the argument that you're making, Dan, is that the most recent information we should ignore because we've gotten other information. Doctors used to give you mercury for syphilis and for other diseases. I mean, we now know that it's a poison. You want to take mercury as a drug if you have a bacterial infection?
Climate changes. The Earth changes, and the Earth is surviving.
And we are cranking up the level of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere dramatically as a consequence of burning the fossil fuels from the companies that you're promoting.
And no one knows whether that is causing massive global warming. We don't have massive global warming. We have a temperature change in over 100 years of slightly more than 1 degree. And, you know, people are painting that like it's the end of the world. It's not even warmer than it was like in the 30s, you know, in the last century. So for people to paint this as a global cataclysm is beyond alarmist. And so that's what I'm seeing. You're asking the United States to devastate its economy, to put millions of people out of
work. No, I'm suggesting that this could be bigger than the dot-com revolution.
Yeah.
The alternative energy revolution could make the dot-com revolution look like nothing. No, I'm saying that what you guys are the dinosaurs here. You're saying, we want to stay with these horses and these buggies. We don't want to go into the automobile age because we don't know if that technology is going to work.
No, see, I'm absolutely not saying that. If you want to push for nuclear power today, I'm for that, too. If you want to push, and again, if businesses discover that, oh, my gosh, hydrogen power works really well, and they can actually make it so that ordinary people can afford a car instead of, I think, one of the...
Solar power works really well. Wind power works really well.
Why do you...
I would suggest, Dan Gehner, that the main reason why you're opposed to alternative energy is because it's free.
I'm not opposed to alternative energy. I'm opposed to what will work in the market. I'm opposed to the government suddenly mandating forced choices. They're going to wipe out.
Well, stick around, Dan. We've got a few callers who want to talk with you, and we'll do one more segment on this. Coming up, more on the man-made death of the Earth with Dan Gehner, businessandmedia.org, his website, the Business and Media Institute. Our number, 866-440-8466. I'm Tom Hart.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Forces of the world unite, let us save the day. Malcontents without 5 cents want us to cut our pay. We only make 500 times as much as our average worker drones. We work just as hard and we too sometimes need to paint our homes. The pressures are incredible and no one seems to care. We moved our plants to Haiti and now we have to move from there. They're clamoring for more than a dollar a day from Malaysia to Mexico. At that rate, pretty soon, there'll be no place for us to go.
Oh, CEOs of the universe, of the world, unite. Indeed, Exxon industry coffers swelling with cash. According to the Wall Street Journal, Exxon Mobil Corp and Royal Dutch Shell both reported huge increases in first quarter income, benefiting from the industry-wide bonanza, also swelling the coffers of their peers. The Wall Street Journal, record profits for Exxon, said net income totaled $7.86 billion, or $1.22 a share, up 44% from $5.44 billion, or 83 cents a share a year earlier. Shell profits up 40%, $30 billion in extra revenue for ConocoPhillips, according to the Houston Chronicle. Total revenue was up $38.9 billion. what to do about with $40 billion in cash, the headache that ExxonMobil is having to deal with. How do they handle all this extra cash? Oil industry executives got a 109.1% raise. And the oil industry now doing something about protecting their profits. They've got the Republicans out there flogging. The Republican National Committee today unveiled a new web ad titled, Democrats Pump Up the Price. Right. And we have Dan Gaynor, the executive director of the Free Market, of the Business and Media Institute, businessandmedia.org, with us. Echoing that line, Dan, I don't mean that as a slap. I mean, that's what you're doing, right?
No, of course not. The Democrats are out there, and I mean, frankly, anybody who's out there pushing for high gas prices, promoting high gas taxes, which is what several of the Democrats have done, the last three Democratic presidential candidates have done. And the Al Gore who's out there going out there right now pushing about global warming is said before.
So you think gas should be cheap so we use more of it?
No, gas should be cheap because if it's what the market will bear, and because it ends up being, and this is something I think your listeners particularly would care about, if gas is expensive, it ends up being a very regressive tax because it hurts ordinary people the most.
It's the only form of transportation available to them.
It's not. Well, for many of them it is. I happen to live outside D.C. D.C. does have nice mass transit, and I'm happy to avail myself of it when possible. But at the same time, some people live further away. Some people live in more rural areas, and pretty much all you got is a car.
Dan Gaynor, the proportion of severely destructive hurricanes that have reached Category 4 and 5 intensity has doubled in the past 30 years. This is from federal government statistics. You say this has got nothing to do with the fact that we're pumping carbon dioxide in the
atmosphere. Well, actually, NOAA, that's the National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration, says it has nothing to do with it. It actually points out that...
No, they say that they can't identify a clear correlation.
Well,
they do not say it has nothing to do with it.
Well, actually, they have said it doesn't. And hurricanes are in a four-decade, somewhere between 25 and 40-year-long decadal cycle. So for somebody to say that we looked at the beginning of that cycle and looked at the end of that cycle and said there's a change is sort of the same kind of junk science you get if somebody looked at June and said the temperature in June was 84 degrees and the temperature in December was, 32.
Okay, let's go. I got the point, Dan. Let's go to our phone calls here. Judy in Dana Point, California. Judy, you're live with Dan Gaynor.
Hello?
Hi, Dan. Hi, Judy. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. I wasn't expecting to get out so fast. I heard a swift vote ad against Jimmy Carter this morning. They have to go all the way back to the 70s to blame him for our oil problems we have today. This is getting to be really kind of ridiculous. I mean, if we listened to Jimmy Carter, we would have been oil-free in 1986. We would have been oil-free. We would not have to depend on...
Foreign oil-free, anyway.
Foreign oil, thank you.
Yeah.
And, this is getting to be kind of sad that they have to go back three decades to start blaming the president who has done nothing but good since he's been out of office. And I think he was a very nice, good president, and he meant well. And to have him do this is absolutely disgusting.
Well, I certainly have nothing to do with the Jimmy Carter attack ads. What I can say is it's not just Jimmy Carter, and I don't believe if we had done what he said that we would be energy independent or oil independent. Our oil demands continue to grow.
But we'll never know because Ronald Reagan came into office. The first thing he did was shut down Carter's programs, take his solar collectors off the roof of the White House, do away with the tax credits, and kill off an emerging solar power industry.
Well, he didn't kill it off. I mean, again, if the industry can survive on its own, it would be doing just fine.
Could say the same thing about the auto industry. But the fact of the matter is the auto industry couldn't survive on its own either. You and I are paying for the roads that are used by cars.
But they're also used by us, and we choose to pay for them.
Exactly, and so with solar power. Come on, Dan.
No, it's not necessarily. Right now, solar power is a niche industry.
So were automobiles in 1910. And we decided that we were going to go out there and we were going to build roads so that Henry Ford could make some money.
Get around. The U.S. economy has grown by leaps and bounds as a result of...
In large part because of our investment in the infrastructure that facilitated automobiles. Isn't it time for us to now invest in an infrastructure that will facilitate renewable energy, even if it makes a little less money for your friends in the oil industry and good old Lee Raymond,
We're investing billions of dollars in infrastructure right now. If it was very close to getting there, great. It's decades away for some of these things.
Let's start right now.
Business Week was estimating, I think, hydrogen power.
Brad, I got a whole pile of callers here, and you know, we got to keep long,
short
questions, short answers here. Brad in Redmond, Washington. Hey, Brad.
Hi. I'm just calling because you made that comment about how if there were profits in the alternative fuels that the oil companies would be going after that as well. I mean, it seems to display sort of a willful ignorance of how big businesses in general and oil companies in particular work. The fact is big businesses can only go after big profits. Small companies can go after small profits. And the oil companies in particular, the way they're structured, they've got two sides of the business. They've got the upstream, that's the drilling and exploration, and the downstream, that's the refining and retail. Right now, the upstream is just pumping money out of the ground. And any alternative fuel would not have that component. And so what they're looking at is if they pursue these alternatives, they're investing a lot of money in something that's going to have a higher variable cost and less percentage profit. So they've got no incentive at all to pursue these alternate technologies. It would be hard to justify to their shareholders.
I disagree completely on both points. First of all, BP, because they are British Petroleum, it's already proving the first point wrong. They are investing.
Actually, it's less than 1% of their revenues are putting into alternative energies.
They're
spending about as much money advertising the fact that they're doing it as they are doing it. It's like back when American Express used to spend more money advertising that you could get your money back from their travelers' checks than they spent on refunding travelers' checks money.
And both solar power and wind power grab energy from elsewhere, much like oil does grab it out of the ground. So if they could do that, and in effect, they would be doing pumping money or pulling money.
But you can pump oil faster. You can force oil out of the ground. You can explore, find more reserves of oil. It's not sustainable. The thing is, you know, any of these alternative sources, they're either using a waste product or they're using something that arrives at a constant rate, like the sun or the wind. So you can't just go find, oh, there's a bunch of solar power waiting to be grabbed. You can't aggressively grab it at an unsustainable rate, and that's the problem.
Yeah, well said, Brad. Dave in Los Angeles, California. Dave, you're live with Dan Gaynor, businessmedia.org.
Hi, Dan, and hi, Tom.
Hi, Dave.
You say you're with the Competitive Enterprise?
No, I'm not. It was one of the list of organizations.
Okay, well, I was just going to point out some of the irony in that as well as what I'm going to say. I don't want to switch gears a little bit from the global warming and the and placing a 24-year-old political hack with a fake resume in NASA to stifle one of the world's experts on it.
You're talking about the Competitive Enterprise Institute?
No, I'm talking about what the Bush administration did over at NASA. What I'd like to bring up is how big oil is a real environmentalist when it works in their favor. In California, back in the late 90s, early 2000, it was big oil that pushed through environmental laws that shut down the independent distributors. And that worked so well, they moved that across the country. And then it worked so well that they used it to shut down the independent refineries. And they did this to drive up the cost. But they were tree huggers at that point.
So, Dan, here we have giant monopolies, these huge companies, you know, Dave's point, and you know, you're dancing to their tunes. I don't understand why.
I'm not dancing to anybody's tune. See, that's the thing. Again, if we could come up, any company wants to push, and they can come up with a viable alternate source. And what's funny is on the left, people talk about alternate energy, and then I see in Washington, what do we got? Ted Kennedy trying to stand in the way of wind power off.
Yeah, I know. It's stupid. It's a NIMBY argument. I agree
with
you. Mike in Richmond, Virginia. Mike, you're live with Dan Gaynor.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Tom.
Hey.
Dan, I have a question for you. In support of your argument that the world is not in a warming trend, you stated that Greenland is no longer green, but is now ice.
I said actually the Earth, I admitted the Earth has indeed warmed about a degree in the last 100 years, which all scientists seem to pretty much concur on.
What was your basis for stating
that? My point is Greenland used to be a lot warmer than it is today. People lived on it, grew crops on it.
Before 1300.
Yeah, exactly. And then things got cooler. And then things have gotten warmer since then.
But what does that have to do with anything?
Well, my understanding was that Greenland has always been ice, and Iceland has always been green.
Not entirely true, Mike. Actually, Dan has a point here on this, but it's like I said, I don't think it's all that relevant. But anyhow, you can learn more about it at businessandmedia.org. Dan Gaynor, thanks for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Good talking with you. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain. We'll be back. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Some of us are illegal and others not wanted. Our work contract's out and we have to move on.
600 miles to the Mexican border. They chase us like rustlers, like outlaws, like thieves.
Goodbye to my one, goodbye Rosalita. Adios, mi amigo, Jesus, Maria.
All right, welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place we're in a Darwinian world of ideas. We're at the top of the food chain. Not unlike good old Lee Raymond, right?
I'm going to eat you.
Uh-oh.
I'm bigger than you. I'm higher in the food chain.
Yeah, there you go. Well, Paula in Carbondale, Illinois, listening on WINI. Hey, Paula.
Hi. Well, actually, I was calling about your guest, or to talk to your guest, but he hung up. But yeah. In the meantime, I had something to disagree with both of you when you said that we, the people, decided to turn to cars and destroy our old public transportation. I have a video I recommend. It's called Taken for a Ride. Mm-hmm. And in it, it shows the public hearings, like in L.A. and Detroit, or in San Francisco, where actually in San Francisco, they stopped the highway. In case you ever wondered why Highway 101 stops in the middle of the city, mm-hmm. they managed to stop it. You know, people did fight back against the destruction of their public transportation, but it didn't do any good because government was in cahoots with the
And in fact, General Motors and Firestone, as I recall, tire company, were prosecuted and convicted.
And Standard Oil, yeah, the three of them.
Of conspiracy.
Yeah.
They went down to Los Angeles. You drive down to Los Angeles, in some places you cross the old Santa Monica Boulevard, you know, the actual street there, and you'll see little remnants of trolley tracks. L.A. had one of the best public transportation systems in the country.
And in that video, you'll see people of L.A. protesting that being destroyed.
Yeah, and these companies went in and they said, let us buy the trolley system, the public transportation system, and we will upgrade it and maintain it. We just want to buy it to make a profit. That's all we want to do. And as soon as the city said, oh, cool, we're going to privatize this. We're going to get all kinds of money for the city coffers, and a few of our politicians are going to get paid off very handsomely, and it'll be good for everybody. And then as soon as they bought it up, they destroyed it.
My point was it wasn't a we the people kind of decision. It was the big business. But the reason I called your guys, because we used to be called free market, and I think that's such a farce. If he really believed in the free market, he would, you know, believe in the ability of small businesses to come in and step over when we take the charters away from the big corporations, which have proven themselves to be destructive to ourselves, our environment, and the, you know, like these coal mines. When people lose their life in a coal mine, that corporation that owns that coal mine should be shut down.
I agree with you. And so would Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican president. You know, and well said, Paul. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. Jimmy Carter laid it out.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation.
This was on July 15th, 1979.
These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
And then Carter went on to say, and we're going to produce 20% of our electricity by the year 2000 from solar power.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
So the cons now, in response, there's this full court press. I mean, and Al Gore is the guy who really stirred this thing up with his movie. His global warming movie that's coming out here, and An Inconvenient Truth. But the cons now are coming out against Jimmy Carter.
Some politicians want to censure President Bush. Why? Because Bush wisely supports wiretapping suspected terrorists. If Congress has an itchy finger to censure someone, they should start with former President Jimmy Carter. In North Korea, Carter's meddling increased nuclear tensions. In Cuba, he's emboldened dictator Fidel Castro. In the Middle East, Carter supported Yasser Arafat and the terrorist organization Hamas. Congress should censure Jimmy Carter for his shameful conduct. Log on to censurejimmycarter.com.
Congress should censure Jimmy. Let's go after Jimmy Carter. Oh, man. Craig in Lynnwood, Massachusetts, or Washington, rather. Hey, Craig, what's up?
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
The reason I'm calling is just the last lady that was talking about the free market just before me.
Paula, yeah.
It just reminded me of how through my whole growing up years, I'm in my 40s, I've heard so many stories of people coming up with like a carburetor that got 80, 100 miles a gallon, different innovations that would make cars get so much better gas mileage, and the oil companies have done their best to buy these things out because they don't want innovation that would help the process and make their product go further, because that just means it'll take longer to sell it.
Yeah, and whether those stories are true or whether they're just apocryphal, is almost beside the point. The reality is that, to quote George W. Bush, we are addicted to oil, and being an addict is not a good thing. And particularly when the pusher that you have to go to happens to hate your guts and is in another part of the world, and the only way that you can get him to continue selling you his goods is by threatening violence, and pretty soon he says, hey, we know how to be violent too.
Well, anytime you're an addict, you got problems.
Yeah. Well, we got problems here in the United States. Craig, thanks for the call.
I wish you well, my good man.
I wish you too well as well. This is just incredible. And then on top of this, of course, Denny Hastert telling us,
if you earned $40,000 a year, you wouldn't get a very big tax cut. Well, folks, if you earn $40,000 a year, a family of two children, you don't pay any taxes.
Aren't you reassured? Everything's wonderful. The Republicans just want you to know. It's the Democrats who want to raise the price of oil, and because if you earn $40,000 or less, you don't pay any taxes like Denny Hastert. Everything's fine. There's no such thing as global warming. There's no consensus. Everything is just fine. Yeah, and be sure to go out and see Al Gore's movie when it comes. It's going to be a week or so here before it comes out, but this I've seen his lecture, and it just knocked my socks off. It was brilliant. We'll be back right after the news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Martin Luther King Jr. The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy. Jeff Johnson is with us with CNS News, Cybercast News Service, CNSnews.com, the conservative news site. I think I can say that, Jeff, can I?
Oh, you can say just about anything you want, Tom. It's your show.
Okay. Well, I want to accurately portray you guys.
Our editorial policy is conservative. Yes, it is.
Right. Okay. You wrote this op-ed piece on May 17th titled, GOP Could Lose Congress, White House on Immigration. And about how George Bush's guest worker program, basically it's an amnesty program, and conservatives know that, and I'd say liberals know that as well, and that you don't think that this is going to go over well with Americans.
Well, it's not what I think. It's what conservatives like Richard Viguerie and Gary Bauer, who ran for president in 2000, Steve Elliott of grassfire.org, have said that their members are telling them of the various organizations that they run. Richard Viguerie is a name that might not be all that well known by your listeners. He essentially is the person who created the conservative direct mail movement that funds a lot of conservative organizations and even some political campaigns now. He's a
president. Right, and has claimed credit for Ronald Reagan's election in 1980.
Right. He is he's a guy who has his finger pretty firmly on the pulse of the conservative wing of the Republican Party, and he believes, as do Gary Bauer and Steve Elliott, that that conservatives are angry over what they feel like is essentially a sellout on the immigration issue and a host of other issues that are important to conservatives that, many of your listeners would probably disagree with, if not most of your listeners would probably disagree with the positions that Richard Viguerie holds, but The fact is that there's a strong base in the Republican Party that hold those positions, and those people will probably determine who gets reelected to Congress from the Republican Party in this year and may determine who is the Republican Party nominee for 2008.
Vigory and many other conservatives very upset about the fact that for 30 years Republicans have been playing the fiddle of we're going to do something about abortion, but they really don't. They don't, you know, they're at, as of this moment, women who get abortions are not put in prison or given lethal injections.
You know, I don't know anyone. I'm sure they're there. I'm sure you can probably cite examples, but I don't know of anyone, and particularly not any leaders in the Republican Party who want those things. I think what they want is to get people to realize that when you say we need to consider the rights of the mother, that we'd like to consider the rights of the unborn child as well.
No,
I don't know anyone who has proposed the death penalty for a woman who feels like she's placed in a position where she has no other choice than abortion.
Well, I do, and I've had several people on from Ralph Reed's organization over the last couple of years who suggested that. In fact, I asked one of them, you know, should women be subject to lethal injection or hanging? And he said, well, it depends on what the laws are in the state. It's murder. They should be, you know, put to death. And, but nonetheless, I mean, you've
makes it really difficult to be a conservative when people are out
well,
there saying
see, this is where I'm going with this, and I just, you know, and I'm not trying to score points here, Jeff. We're talking with Jeff Johnson. He's the senior staff writer for CNS News. This I think is worthy of an honest discussion where we just lay it out here. You have on the conservative side, you've got folks who want to make, let's say, to sugarcoat it, want to make abortion illegal, who are concerned that the deficit spending is way out of control. Now, you've got people on both sides, frankly, there, that who are concerned that the Pentagon, having misplaced $2.3 trillion, $21,000 per family in America, is at the very least not conservative. I'd say it's not anything. I'd say it's anti-American. But by and large, the conservative and Vigory, he says, at the very least, conservatives must stop funding the Republican National Committee and other party groups and redirect their anger into building a third force. And he's talking about, you know, splitting off from the Republican Party.
Well, actually, what he's talking about is what he calls retaking the Republican Party.
Right.
Richard Vigory, just to add a little bit to his biography, has been around since Barry Goldwater. Actually, I think Barry Goldwater was the first national campaign he worked on, and he helped Goldwater essentially take the Republican Party. Now, that only lasted for about 4 to 6 months, depending on who you ask. But, you know, there is a political party for folks who believe that abortion should be legal at any time during a pregnancy or most of the time during a pregnancy. There is a party.
I don't think anybody thinks abortion should be legal any time during a pregnancy. That's a red herring. And I don't think that we need to be arguing abortion, but I don't think that anybody, I don't know, you know, I have never, ever talked to a narrow person who says, you know, a day before somebody's going to give birth, they should be able to get an abortion.
Well, that in fact, under the Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court, is the law as it exists right now. So if they're fighting to protect that,
protect. It's not. You're misrepresenting. But
I don't think so. But anyway, the point
I encourage you to go back and read the decision.
I've got both of them right here. I've read them.
You know, they define these three trimesters.
Yeah.
But we're not, you know, I don't want to debate abortion with you. The point that I wanted to make Jeff Johnson, is that it seems to me that the reason why the conservative movement wants to split away from the Republican Party is because, A, and I think we can agree with this, that they're not happy with the direction the Republicans are going, that the reason that the Republicans have been going in that direction is because it is, in some ways, in some small ways, consistent with what Americans want. In other words, if, for example, if the budget was to be balanced, the only way that the budget could be balanced right now, particularly given these huge tax cuts that Bush has put into place for wealthy people in the United States, is by massively cutting social spending programs, essentially privatizing Social Security, rolling back Medicare, and doing away with welfare programs.
I would think that one way that you could just massively reduce the deficit right now is for all Democrat and Republican lawmakers to stop putting earmarks into the appropriations bills for their little pet projects in their district. And I think
know that that's a pimple on the butt of a rhinoceros. I mean, that's nothing. That is
an interesting analogy.
Yeah. Well,
you know, but here's the point. Let's face it. It doesn't matter whether there's a D or an R after your name. If the REP or SEN gets put in front of your name and you end up in Congress and stay there very long, you start spending money on or trying to spend money on things that the Constitution does not authorize the federal government to spend money on.
No, but let me just make my point here,
sure,
Jeff. I've been trying to get to this for 5 minutes, and we
it's
keep going
show.
Off on these digressions here. And the point is, my point is that the vast majority of Americans don't want what you want.
Well,
that the conservative agenda is only able to be advanced by one of two means. Either by integrating it with more traditional American agendas, like, yes, we're in favor of Social Security, and therefore we're going to fix it by privatizing it, which is essentially dishonest. Back in the old days, I mean, you know, back in the 40s, the Republicans were at least up front. They said, you know, we're the party of big business, we're the party of rich people, we're the party of inherited wealth, and we think that Social Security is socialism.
Well,
we think that labor should not have protections under law.
If what you described, if the Republican Party today is the party of, and I won't get the whole list right, but of big business, of what were the other two, inherited wealth, and what was the other one?
Well, that's
okay, but for the point, if that is the GOP of today, then most conservatives I know don't want to be a part of that, because what most conservatives I know want to be a part of is a political system that is controlled at the local level, that allows people who are actually present where the problems are to solve the problem, and not have somebody in Washington who's never even been to your neighborhood telling you that because it worked on this coast, it has to work over there on your coast.
Tell that to the people in New Orleans.
I don't think anybody in New Orleans wants Washington to solve their problems for them after the way they screwed up the response.
Well, see, that's the point. What conservatives do is they break government, and then they say, oh, look, it's broken. We should do away with it.
If that's...
FEMA was working fine before George Bush came along and put a horse breeder in charge of it.
Having dealt with FEMA before in my previous career as a law enforcement officer, I disagree with that assessment, but you're entitled to your opinion, especially since it's your show.
Well, people weren't... come on, Jeff. Let's not be petulant here. People weren't dying as a consequence. You know, when Hurricane Charlie came through Florida, FEMA showed up. Before the hurricane was there, they were there with 100,000 meals.
FEMA was on its way before Katrina hit, and they were turned around because they didn't want their trailers underwater.
I'm sorry?
FEMA was on the way to New Orleans before Katrina hit, and they were stopped and turned around and told that they couldn't deploy where they were scheduled to deploy because they figured that their supplies were going to be destroyed by the storm, so they backed away.
And where were they after the storm?
I don't work for FEMA, Tom. Okay. I'm not here to
see. That's my
FEMA.
Point, Jeff. Is that I think most Americans actually want a government that works and that does provide a social safety net. And I think that conservatives conservatives don't want that for philosophical reasons. And you know, philosophically, it sounds great. But when the rubber hits the road, you know, people say, hey, wait a minute. I really would like the government involved in my life to a certain level, and I'm willing to pay for it. I do want police protection. I do want fire out there. I do want protection from catastrophic consequences. And it just seems that to me that the only way the reason why the conservatives have never succeeded in truly capturing control of the government, except for that period from 1880 to arguably the beginning of Teddy Roosevelt's administration, the death of McKinley, is that Americans don't want it.
Oh, and that little 1994 thing, too.
What 1994?
84, I'm sorry. That little, what was it called, Republican Revolution?
You really think that running up a greater debt than all other presidents in the history of America is conservative?
Ask Mikhail Gorbachev what he thinks about it.
Well, yeah, he got Osama bin Laden's claiming credit for bringing him down. Jeff Johnson, CNSNews.com. Jeff, good talking to you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Living in the future in a plastic dome sounds mighty strange, I agree. But now I call it home, sweet home, that's where I long to be, yeah. Living in the future in a plastic dome sounds mighty strange, I agree. But now I call it home, sweet home, that's where I long to be.
What a strange song. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, talkradionews.com, their website. Lots of good news over there. Hey, Ellen, what's up?
There's a couple interesting things. One is it now comes out that that computer that was lost for the Department of Veterans Affairs was actually lost 3 weeks ago, but what? Nobody was notified about it. And what's also interesting is that they have now, they're not publicizing this yet, but we have one of our stations in Ohio called me with this information, and there is an emergency call center, in other words, one of these centers that you can just sort of hire to do any kind of emergency calls or any kind of calls that need to be sent out. And they've hired one emergency call center that we know of and probably all over the country to talk to veterans and to warn them to, you know, look at their credit card statements, to check their Social Security, et cetera, because of the stolen computer.
Wow. And one more whack at government here.
That's your taxpayer dollars at work calling call centers.
Yeah, well, you know, this is a tough one. I just, you know, when ChoicePoint had a million records stolen, as I recall, or a whole bunch of records, it was something in that neighborhood. And I mean, there have been several of these things in the last few years. This is just one of several. Maybe it wasn't quite as many names, I suppose. It's just.
No, but there have been several. Remember, there was, and what's also interesting, if you recall, remember when that Pentagon computer was stolen from a secure room, I'm sorry, not State Department, computer was stolen from a secure room during the, when Madeleine Albright was Secretary of State, and the Republicans talked about the lax Clinton security. And,
oh, they beat Bill Clinton up so bad with that.
And here, you hear one Republican host yelping, saying a word. Not exactly.
No.
Also, the Pentagon released, and there's actually a, since you referred people to our website, a little more complete report on the website as well as a link to the Pentagon's website that has this report on the Republic, People's Republic of China. The big question is, it's very clear that they are increasing or they're having a military expansion. And the report wonders, well, what is the purpose of China's military expansion? I don't think you need to be a rocket scientist to get that. That one out.
Yes, but, six letters. Taiwan.
That's right, and make sure that we wouldn't want anybody in Tibet or anything to act.
Well, I would also suggest that they probably view themselves. Well, not probably. Actually, I've lived in China for a little while in late 1986, and in fact wrote about it in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and they were pretty upfront back in 86. I mean that. They saw the next millennium, the next century, starting in the year 2000, as the Chinese century. That there had been the European century, then there was the American century, and now was coming the Chinese century, and that they were going to have to project force all over the world. And, you know, now they're cutting deals all over the world to secure oil and other energy sources. And they need a robust military to protect that.
Cutting deals, they're trying to beat our, you know what, in the upcoming Olympics, they have a joint training center with India.
Yeah, what a surprise. And we're paying for it all.
I'm sure we are. Also, on the immigrants issue, that bill is still coming before the Senate. Dianne Feinstein put forth an amendment, 61-37. It did not pass. It would have put most immigrants on the path to citizenship. And Mr. Boehner, just because he's speaking this week to the Family Research Council doesn't mean he's not trying to get his agenda through in Congress. The ANWR upcoming campaign. 2,000, he said, of 20 million acres would be used for drilling, and he is going to have that bill voted on this week.
What's your take, Alan Ratner, on this full court press against Al Gore's global warming message? I mean, there's now...
he might actually win for president.
Yeah, well, you think that that's it? You think it's about politics and it's not about the oil companies throwing money at
this? Well, clearly it is, but the oil companies are behind who they want to have for president because they've got Mr. Bush.
Yeah.
So it's the same deal. I mean, it's not one or the other. They're equal.
I mean, on Fox News, you've got Steve Forbes on there saying, you know, if Al Gore's vision is realized, it'll destroy the American economy. You know, it's a real recipe for more socialist regulation, actually, was his verbatim quote.
Rumor has it that Mr. Forbes is tight as a tick on his personal life. I mean, he doesn't give a penny to anybody, so.
Yeah. Well, he's certainly nobody would accuse Steve Forbes of being a socialist, I suspect.
Absolutely not.
But maybe somebody who has obsessive-compulsive disorder around money. I just don't know. But
although Hillary Clinton is now singing some of this, she was at the National Press Club this morning talking about needing more ethanol research and proposing a 50% tax credit for stations that have ethanol pumps.
And a $50 billion fund for new energy. I mean, this actually seems like a good idea to me.
Yeah, actually a good idea.
You look at how much money we spent in the war in Iraq. If we had spent a small fraction of that, we could be independent of...
At the end of this year, says Mr. Murtha, $650 billion in Iraq.
Wow. Now, and I just had a guy on from, you know, one of these right-wing think tanks saying that the reason why we can't go to alternative energy is because it would cost us $400 billion to do it.
Yeah, You know where I put my money.
Yeah, there you go. Ellen Radner, TalkRadioNews.com,
Talk
Radio News Service. Thank you, Ellen. Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your radio support group, of, by, and for we the people of the United States. Our number 866-440-8466. We'll be back with your calls and more right after this. Stick around.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. We're coming up on 25 before. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. You can drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com. Just click live chat up at the top of the page. Charles in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, what's going on? You still there?
Yeah, I am. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm having trouble with my phone just now coming down the hill. I've been hearing you.
Okay, Charles, I'm gonna put you on hold, and we'll come back to you in just a second. Hopefully you'll be in a little better spot there. Mike in Darien, Washington. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Well, Tom, you're up. I want to take you to task over your issue that everybody that we buy oil hates our guts. You sound a little bit like Rush Limbaugh or Hannity. What are those right-wing nuts? I mean, that's not the case. Who really hates us that sells us oil?
My point was that our policies that we have been pursuing of propping up corrupt dictatorships are not gaining us friends, and that we've been pursuing those policies because of our addiction to oil. Do you deny that?
No. I agree. It's this administration and prior that have driven a wall between us
and this is not, frankly, a Democratic or Republican issue. This is an American foreign policy issue that's been driven by big oil.
Oh yes, indeed. It's this corrupt administration has really widened the gap. And number two, this fella from CNS.
Yeah.
What's his name?
I'd have to go back and look here. Jeff Smith.
Jeff Smith.
Dan Gaynor was our first in the first hour. And then Mr. Johnson and then Jeff.
Well,
second.
As far as I'm concerned, I'm sure you are too. The Republican Party is dead. They're not conservatives, and they're talking about a split. All they're talking about right now is a split between the conservative right wing and the ultra right wing religious based ex-Republicans. This is what's driving Republican politics right up into Boehner, Santorum, who is basically, I don't know if he's a member of Opus Dei or a big supporter, but the Opus Dei is a very, very wacko Catholic SS group, and Santorum is based out of their organization, as with Blackwell, who is being supported by Opus Dei. Now, this ultra-right-wing nutcase is basically eating up the Republicans.
Well, and my point is that the whether or not Santorum's in Opus Dei, I don't know. I mean, there's been a lot of speculation about at least three Supreme Court justices, at a certain level, that kind of speculation can also devolve into the Catholic version of anti-Semitism. What would you call it? Anti-Catholicism, I suppose. The larger point is that these extreme conservative positions that want to criminalize abortion. That want to keep the United States addicted to oil. That want to project a foreign policy that is aggressive and bellicose. Want to intrude into the private lives of Americans. Want to listen to our phone conversations. On and on and on it goes. They are not the mainstream of America. That's my point.
And this is what's permeating this administration. This is what's driving the base of this administration right now. Yeah. That's why they're so hell bent on researching our private lives.
Yeah, and I guarantee you that they are going to be coming out of the woodwork hugely for the elections this fall. I mean, their agenda only works when they can terrify people. The biggest terrorists in America right now are inside the Republican Party because they only are able to get elected by terrorizing people, by creating terror in people, whether it's terror of Democrats raising their gas prices or whether it's terror of Arabs coming to get you. This goes back to Tom. I realize it's a very strong statement to make, but when you've got Tom Ridge coming out and saying that he was raising the terror alerts during the election of 2004 over and over and over again, every time John Kerry got a little bit of traction because the White House told him to, not because he thought it was a good idea, you have to conclude that this bunch are terrorists because they get what they want by the use of terror. Charles in Dayton, Ohio. You want to try it again, Charles?
Yeah, I'm here, bud.
Okay, go for it.
Am I?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, good deal. Yeah, I just want to make you aware of a couple of technologies that are currently available. One of those is the Coates Spherical Rotary Valve Engine. It's basically a headset, and it can be retrofit onto basically any engine you see rolling down the road today, small block, Chevy, Ford, whatever. Just to give you an idea, they both just set these heads on a stock 302 and came up with 475 horsepower. Just to give you an idea of the power of these heads. Now, the thing is, they're also very efficient in heat and oil.
Yeah. So Charles, here's the question: if there are more efficient engines out there, then why aren't the car manufacturers, who really don't have a dog in the fight of oil, why aren't they selling them? I mean, I know that, for example, in Europe, General Motors is selling cars that get 60 miles to the gallon. You know,
right.
they're Opel diesel cars. I mean, you know, they're all over the place. And in Brazil, General Motors is selling cars that are flex fuel cars that you can run on ethanol. Why is it that in the United States they're not selling highly fuel-efficient cars?
Because each of these companies, to speak with this genius, Dr. Coates, they want to own the patent on those heads.
But the bottom line is that they're being eaten alive by Honda and Toyota.
That's right.
I mean, how does that benefit them?
I'm hauling Toyota parts right now, Tom.
There you go. I mean, how does that benefit General Motors? I it just seems to me like it's really stupid management.
Well, that's just one of the technologies I'm talking about also. There's an engine called the Rand Cam engine. It's built something like a turbine, produces something like 16 power strokes per revolution.
Right.
Currently being used in military generators, or at least they have a contract. I think they're being used right now. But Coates is also doing research on big truck engines, semi-truck engines.
Yeah. So, Charles, the bottom line is that, you know, there's no shortage of technological solutions here. And I think that you're making my point that we really need to just open this stuff up and we need to be thinking outside the box. Instead of saying, gee, where do we find more oil or how do we pump more oil, we need to be looking at alternatives to that, and efficiency in the use of the oil that we have right now certainly should be at the very front of the line.
Well, maybe once the people get control of the government again and get wrenched away from the corporatists, maybe we can do some good for the people and start looking at these other available technologies and start expanding them.
There you go.
Things like biodiesel and things that are just right as plain as the nose on your face.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. Charles, thanks a lot for the call. It's I hope so. We'll see. But in the meantime, I mean, this program of spreading fear and hate is continuing. And a good chunk of it is based in the idea of creating what are called straw men. A straw man argument is a phony argument. You create a phony enemy so that you can knock them over. So, you know, Bill O'Reilly, whose ratings are tanking. The guy is going off the edge of the earth. His show has fallen apart, and he's out there, you know, quack, 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 going on and on about how Think Progress and Media Matters, thinkprogress.org and mediamatters.org. Well, let me set this up for you. Think Progress and Media Matters pointed out a week or so ago that Mara Liasson, who is a reporter for National Public Radio, now referred to very often as National Republican Radio, because of its openly Republican takeover of its board of directors, that NPR, Mara Liasson on NPR, came out and said, and I quote, "It's Democrats, not just Republicans, taking money from Abramoff," end quote. And in fact, it's not true. No Democrat has ever taken money from Abramoff. Period. End of discussion. I mean, Howard Dean has said it over and over again. It's just, it has not happened. The Democrats have not taken money from Abramoff. Ever. And you know, the flip side of that is Abramoff would not give money to Democrats. He wouldn't do it. He wouldn't have anything to do with it. So it wasn't true. But it is one of the right-wing lies that got picked up by NPR, by Mara Liasson. So when Media Matters pointed this out, they suggested that their listeners should drop a note to the ombudsman or the people at NPR and let them know that they put a lie on the air. They're repeating the Republican talking points. And the ombudsman for NPR said, boy, we sure got a huge response from that. So O'Reilly takes this thing that's between Think Progress and NPR about Mara Liasson repeating one of the Republican lies. And he tries to make it that he has something to do with it. He tries to pretend like he's in the middle of this when he's not even related to it.
The ombudsman for NPR recently lashed out at two dishonest far-left websites, Media Matters and Think Progress, for urging their readers to complain to the National Public Radio because some of their contributors appear here on the Fox News channel.
You get that? Complain because they appear on the Fox News? No, I'm sorry. It never had anything to do with that whatsoever. It was because Mara Liasson said it's Democrats, not just Republicans, taking money from Abramoff, and that's not true.
Jeffrey Dworkin wrote, quote, the blogs encourage people to complain to NPR and hundreds did, many with a surprising level of rancor and vituperation.
Now, notice the ombudsman for NPR never once mentioned Fox.
Which was shockingly intense, even in these times of take no prisoners and shoot the wounded political debate. The ombudsman has now learned firsthand just how vicious the far left blogs are. All decent Americans should reject these haters.
Yes, all decent Americans should reject O'Reilly. It's 45 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least clean elections. We'll start with that.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
From some ancient fight about the size of a fist, something thrown that had missed. There were other holes as well.
And welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, Karl Rove is at it again. In today's Wall Street Journal, an op-ed that is lying about the Bush lies. I mean, this is absolutely mind-boggling. There's enough to it. I mean, there's so much to it. I don't think, frankly, I have enough time in the rest of this hour to get into all the details of it, so we'll do it in the next hour. But it is incredible what Karl Rove is up to right now, any day before he gets indicted. I understand the grand jury is going to meet tomorrow. We'll see what happens. Richard in Washington State. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, Tom, an honor and a privilege. Thank you.
Well, thank you for calling.
You keep asking what sounds a rhetorical question. Why does GM and other automakers keep building these huge behemoth cars when around the world they're obviously able to produce these more fuel-efficient cars? Okay. You probably saw these Tahoe commercial parodies where they were just ripping them for their environmental short-sightedness.
Yeah.
Well, I started surfing around looking after I looked at those ads and got a good chuckle. And then, you know, I'm looking at these cars and looking at what they're selling around the world, and then it struck me why they're producing them here. It's to break the unions. If they can produce these cars in America at a loss, people aren't buying them now because of the gas prices. If they can force the employees to produce cars that people aren't buying, they have an excuse to break the unions. They can outsource their jobs once that mission's and absorb those losses while still selling fuel-efficient cars around the world. They can absorb those losses, break the unions, and then once they've accomplished that goal, then they can go about producing the same fuel-efficient cars that they're producing around the world.
But they don't have to bankrupt themselves to do that, Richard. I mean, remember Roger and Me, the Michael Moore's first movie?
Sure.
That was all about GM closing down their production facility in Flint, Michigan, and moving it down to Mexico. They closed 4 factories in the United States, and they opened 4 factories in Mexico. All those union jobs were gone in the United States. They didn't have to produce cars that nobody wanted to buy.
Well,
and they were more profitable as a consequence of it.
True, they are, but there's a lot of political incentive for them also to produce these big cars because of the oil companies. You know, there may not be a direct in-your-pocket link, but clearly they're trying to help the oil companies of this country as opposed to Venezuela and other
countries. See, I think in part they're responding to a political pressure, and they failed to anticipate the consequences of this. And the political pressure is one that I didn't even know existed prior to... let's see, what year would it have been? It would have been about 8 years ago or so. It was 11 years ago. Louise and I were moving from Atlanta to Vermont, and we had bought a house in Vermont in Northfield. It's a rural town south of Montpelier, and it was out in the woods, and it had a half-mile-long dirt road driveway that dead-ended into the house on the side of a mountain. And we needed a four-wheel drive vehicle. And we were going to buy it with our, we had a company that we, you know, run the income from my writing and things through.
Yeah.
And this was before I'd started doing this radio program. So we needed to buy a car, and we were going to have the company buy the car because the company's offices were going to be there, and, you know, you can write it off. And there's
sure.
all good reasons, right? So my CPA, I call my CPA, and I say, you know, I'm going to buy a car. How do I do this? You know, do I put it in the company name, in my name jointly, whatever? You know, just asking, like, the technical questions. And he says, be sure you buy a car that weighs at least 1 pound more than 6,000 pounds. And I said, why? And he said, because you have a profit in the corporation this year. There was money there left over that I hadn't paid to myself. And he said, because there, if a car weighs more than 6,000 pounds and you have a small business, you can write off, and at that time it was $17,000. Now it's up to $100,000. You can write off up to $17,000 in 1 year and call it equipment rather than an automobile. This is a loophole that was originally put in for agricultural, for farm equipment. Whereas if you just buy a car, he said the most that you can write off is about $2,000 a year. And he says, you've got, you know, I don't remember how much profit we had in there. It was, you know, $10,000, $12,000, something like that. And he says, you can just write the whole thing off and pay no taxes on it. So, in effect, the taxpayers of America are paying half the cost of your car, or 35% of it, because that's the corporate tax rate. So, you know, the taxpayers of America are paying 35% of the cost of your car. And so, you know, do that. So it was really interesting. So Louise and I went out, because we needed to get a four-wheel drive vehicle anyway, right? And this was,
right.
You know, back, nobody was worried about gasoline. And I was, frankly, this was 2 years, 3 years before I wrote Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. In fact, this was one of the things that got me started investigating the oil crisis, right? So we go out and we went down to the Land Rover dealership, and I said, you know, what do you have here? And the guy says, well, we've got this one and this one and this one. And I'm like, how much do they weigh? And he gets this big smile on his face. He says, well, this one weighs 6,003 pounds, and this one weighs 6,012 pounds. And I called up Chevy, and you want to buy a Suburban? Yes. By the way, they weigh 6,030 pounds.
They knew that right off the top of their heads.
That's right. They absolutely did. And it turns out, and I asked this guy, at the Land Rover dealership, I said, what percentage of the cars that you guys are selling are being sold to people like me, you know, small business people, you know, doctors, lawyers, professionals, or whatever, you know, anybody who can run their income through a corporation? And he said about 3/4 of them. So I would suggest to you that probably the reason why these companies in America have been making these cars is because they're being supported by the taxpayers.
They can write them off.
Because people like me can write them off.
Right.
Or people like you, if you want to start a little corporation, costs you $300 to incorporate in Washington, and there you go. You can write off up to $100,000 in income into your car, whereas if you buy your car with your own personal money, you have to pay taxes on that money first.
You're absolutely right, and I just want to make one more small point. Is I think you're absolutely right on. When you compare the cost of the war in Iraq to the cost of converting to alternative energy fuels in America, it's a no-brainer. It would have been cheaper by far to just invest that money in America and create alternative energy.
Yeah, absolutely, and it would have created a zillion jobs.
A zillion jobs, yeah.
Well, Richard, thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks.
Good to hear from
time.
You, and thanks for listening to us there on Talk 1090 in Seattle. Stick around after the break to learn more about promoting social, economic, and environmental justice around the world, and particularly here at home, with Kevin Danaher of Global Crossing. We'll be back in just a few minutes, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Broadcasting from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in Little Beirut, People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. Tom Hartman with you, 6 minutes past the hour in the third hour of our program. Kevin Donaher is with us. He's the co-founder of the San Francisco-based human rights organization Global Exchange and the author or editor of 11 books, globalexchange.org, the website. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's nice to be on with you, Tom. I really appreciate your show. My wife, Medea Benjamin, and I listen to your show all the time. We love it.
Thank you. Thank you. You are two extraordinary people who are doing really extraordinary work out there in the world, and I just want to tip my hat to you. By the way, this is our Bioneers segment for the week. Founded in 1990, Bioneers is a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. Their website, bioneers.org. And Kevin, you're our Bioneers guest of the day. Over at Global Exchange, on your website, globalexchange.org, you have a great little primer, I guess, depending on what part of the country you're from, the undemocratic institutions that run the global economy.
Yeah.
And you're using things like travel plans and things to help wake people up to the consequences of things like the World Trade Organization, NAFTA, CAFTA, et cetera.
Right. We do what we call reality tours. It's like reverse Club Med, you know, get people off the beach and meet real people and take them out, and they visit development projects, literacy campaigns, peasant groups, women's groups, all sorts of grassroots development projects, and they can see that there's a whole other world out there, a world that's not about Bush and invading countries for oil. It's about people creating democracy from the grassroots up, which I think if you look at what's going on in the elections in Latin America with all these populist leaders getting elected, there's a wave out there that's taking place, a democratic wave from the grassroots. We take people out, they can see it, go visit these people, hang out with them, party with them, dance with them, fall in love and get inspired and realize, hey, if these people are creating democracy in situations where they could get shot in the street for demanding the right to vote, then we should be able to exercise our right to vote. Half of our population doesn't even bother to vote. So it's not only a learning activity, it's inspirational in that people come back and they say, hey, we gotta take our country back from these shyster oligarchs that have taken it over.
Which raises the question, Kevin. I've been in a few countries that were going through the kind of convulsions that you're talking about and where people were actually getting very involved in democratic processes or in at least resisting anti-democratic or fascistic or tyrannical or whatever, you know, come up with a label, regimes. And there are some who suggest that, in fact, I interviewed this morning, I think it was Morris Berman. Hang on just a second here. Yeah, Morris Berman, he's got this new book, Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire. And, you know, he's basically saying, the game's over, the party's over, you know, check out. We're screwed. We're doomed.
Yeah.
I'm not there yet. And then I've got other people who say, you know, what we really need is the Great Depression, or we really need, this is kind of the Tim McVeigh scenario. Tim McVeigh thought that by blowing up the federal building in Oklahoma City, that all the good white Protestants in America, gun owners in America, would rise up against the federal government because the federal government would overreact.
Yeah.
And he thought he was going to create a revolution of white people in America, right? But there are people who say, you know, things have to get a whole lot worse before they get better. I don't think so. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, what we see going on is we co-produce, along with Co-op America, the Green Festival, which happens in Washington, D.C. in October, San Francisco in November, Chicago in April. This is a huge green economy event with like 400 green economy companies, 50 speakers, music, food, workshops. And there's a whole revolution going on out there, and it's the local green economy, because people realize the basis of empire is transnational corporations. They're not locally rooted in place, as we see the way they took our manufacturing sector and moved it to China, and they're not green. They see a 2,000-year-old redwood tree not as a gift of the creator, but as $250,000 worth of lumber on the lumber market, so they kill it. A fish swimming has no value. It's only when you kill it and turn it into a marketable commodity, and that's why they're destroying the environment. So people realize, well, the opposite of an institution that's not locally rooted and is not green is the local green economy, and that's the future. So the challenge for us as Americans is, how are we going to make a transition from being an empire to being just a nation in a community of nations and being a good neighbor. This, you know, put up the fence on the border. There's more people dying crossing that border with Mexico than died crossing the Berlin Wall under communism. And we thought that was a great human rights violation, and now these clowns are talking about, oh, build the bigger fence, yeah, as if that's going to solve the problem. You got to deal with the Mexican economy being run by the World Bank, the IMF, and a bunch of big banks. Mexico has tons of wealth. It has enough wealth to support its own people. But NAFTA is wrecking their corn market because you got subsidized U.S. corn going in there, driving their corn farmers out of business. Their coffee farmers are being knocked out of business by the big coffee companies. So, of course, they come here looking for work because they can't find a decent job.
Well, on the flip side of that is, too, we're creating a huge magnet here on this side of the border by saying that, as this piece of legislation that just came out of the Senate, it actually has a sentence in it that says employers cannot be prosecuted for hiring people who are not citizens.
Well, you wouldn't want to hurt the corporate donors who are writing your campaign.
There you go. So, you know, it's the bust the unions on this side, bust the people on that side. It's nuts all the way around. So Kevin, you're not of the opinion that America has to fall apart before we can put her back together.
Not at all. In fact, what's happening is a whole new society is being born within the old one. Wind energy right now, electricity from wind energy is price competitive with electricity from natural gas. California, number one source of electricity, natural gas. If you look at all sectors of the economy, whether it's food, transportation, building, the fastest growing segment is the green segment. Those pieces that are saying, okay, as nature gets destroyed, the value of technology and enterprise that saves nature goes up in value. And you're seeing people take stuff out of the waste stream and make sellable products. That's what compost is. That's what recycling is. And all of those sectors are growing rapidly. Organic agriculture is growing a lot faster than chemical agriculture. Chemical agriculture is going to go out of existence when the petroleum runs out, or when the petroleum is like $500 a barrel, which, you know, that'll eventually happen. So what's going on is a revolution in looking at how do we make profit by, one, saving the environment, and two, being concerned with social equity. That triple bottom line is going to be more powerful than a single bottom line that only focuses on money, money, money.
And yet at the same time, Kevin Donaher with globalexchange.org, we have a media that in the United States where more than 90% of the news information that the average American acquires comes from one of four corporations.
Yeah.
Over 95% comes from one of five corporations.
Well, they privatized the public airwaves. It's the public airwaves, and they privatized it, and now it's corporate property. And see, what most people don't understand about the media is we are not the consumer. We are the product being marketed. The consumer is the corporate advertiser that's paying the bills. And they're paying for access to our minds, and they want to fill it with junk, because if they filled it with knowledge and wisdom, then we wouldn't be good consumers. We wouldn't be, you know, little chipmunks on a treadmill buying whatever garbage they throw at us. So it's exactly the reverse of what they told us in Econ 101, you know, consumer sovereignty. You don't like the newspaper, don't buy it. That isn't the way it works. When you buy that newspaper, it probably costs like $5 to make each one of those newspapers, and what's paying for it is the advertising, and that's the real consumer. We're the product being marketed.
That's really interesting, because I don't think that most Americans think of themselves as a product that is being marketed by media corporations to corporations that want to sell things to us.
It's like slavery. Slavery was the marketing of human bodies. This is the marketing of human minds, which is even more dangerous because people don't realize they're slaves. They don't realize they're being marketed and served up on a platter. Why is it that the cost of an ad on the Super Bowl goes way up? It's because they're offering up more brains to be penetrated, more eyeballs, right? So this is something that's got to get out there to people and realize, look, the public airwaves belong to us. It's just like the White House. It's public housing. We own all of this stuff, but we're not asserting our rights of property ownership. And, you know, people have this notion government's the boss and we're the workers. No, government is the worker. We're the boss. Bush works for us. And I like Jim Hightower's idea. He says all these public officials, like members of Congress, they should wear uniforms like cops and firefighters, and we'll make it like NASCAR suits, and they have decals of the corporations that give them money relative to the size of the money they get.
That's great.
And that would be transparency. We'd say, oh, he's the senator from Exxon. It would all be very out in the open.
All right, yeah. Well, increasingly, they're unashamed of it as it is. I mean, you got Richard Pombo out there. I mean, you know, some of these guys, it's just it's mind-boggling. It's totally mind-boggling. And we need to be taking back this country. And part of taking back this country is realizing that this country is interdependent, interpenetrated by and interdependent with the rest of the world, both socially, culturally, environmentally, economically. And Global Exchange, globalexchange.org, doing a great job of helping people wake up to that and the consequences of that. I mean, the upside, the downside, the whole bit.
Thanks.
Kevin Donner, thanks for being with us today.
Appreciate it.
Kevin, the co-founder of the San Francisco-based human rights organization Global Exchange, their website globalexchange.org. Check it out. And he's also the author editor of 11 books. You can find it at your favorite bookstore and, of course, all the usual suspects online. It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. The original, indeed. The Tom Hartman radio program where we run rings around the right wing every single day. 972 days, 10 hours, 38 minutes, 43 seconds, 41 seconds, 39 seconds, until George W. Bush leaves office voluntarily, barring impeachment. I just, you know, hope springs eternal, you know?
All right, Republicans, line up for duty. Where are you going? Hey!
Hey, where are you going?
Kicking off. Kicking off.
Hey, there's a war going on.
Kicking off.
There's some people kicking serving.
Carl Rove, he didn't serve. Dick Cheney. He didn't serve. Tom DeLay. He didn't serve. And George Bush was AWOL. Chicken
hawks. Yes, the news from Iraq, Baghdad, five people were killed and five wounded when a car bomb exploded, targeting a police patrol in eastern Baghdad. In Aswad, gunmen killed three men and wounded seven along a crowd of workers looking for day laboring jobs on farms in the small town of Aswad near Bakhaba. The northeast of Baghdad police said the workers were from a nearby Shiite town. Aswad is mainly Sunni. Ayin al-Tamur. Iraqi police found the bodies of four people handcuffed, blindfolded, and shot dead. This a phenomenon that has been increasing ever since Death Squad John Negroponte went over for a brief stint as ambassador to Iraq. All of a sudden we started finding death squads operating in the country, just sort of like they did after he went down to Central America back during the Reagan administration. And all the death squads started showing up in Honduras and El Salvador and Nicaragua. Anyhow, Iraqi police found the bodies of four people handcuffed, blindfolded, and shot dead in the town of Ayin al-Tamur, about 90 kilometers south of Baghdad. In Najaf, four mortar rounds landed in different districts of the Shiite city of Najaf, 160 kilometers south of Baghdad, wounding four people late on Monday, police said. And in Baghdad, gunmen killed Ahmed Ali Hussein, a professor at Baghdad's Technology University in northeastern Baghdad, police said. So, our chicken hawk alert for the day. Just times of war, I think it's important to revisit it. Although, you know, is this a war? I don't think, you know, I just, it's an occupation. We are not fighting against another government. A war is, you know, where one country fights against another country. We're not fighting a war. I'm sorry, there's no war on. I mean, there's the metaphorical war. You've got the war against drugs. You've got a war against poverty. You've got a war against terrorism. Yeah, but, you know, when these cons stand up and go, well, in time of war, we've got to do away with civil liberties. It's like, no, I'm sorry. You can't use that excuse to take my country away from me. Ain't going to work. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, what's up? What's up?
Tom, I read an interesting article in the Conservative National Newspaper. It was dated May 22nd of this year. There was a meeting in March of 2005 in Waco, Texas, that consisted of President Bush, President Fox of Mexico, and Prime Minister Martin, I believe his name is, from Canada.
Yeah, you're talking about the proposal to create a North American
Union.
Union, yeah.
With their own 15-man council, five from each country, that will have the powers to overrule even our Supreme Court.
Well, it didn't get much publicity, did it?
No, it didn't get much publicity, but what caused me to wonder now about the fence that's going up all of a sudden at the Mexican border?
There's no fence.
Is that to keep us in?
Yeah, well, they're gonna build a fence along, what, 200-300 miles? This is a 1,000-mile border?
Yeah, 3,000-mile
It's not a fence that's going up. It's a billboard.
Well, you know what?
It's a billboard that says, vote for George W. Bush. He pretends to care for you.
Right, but what I really think, I think that this incident, if you know anything about it, should be get out to the American people, because if this isn't an overthrow of our own government by the President of the United States, I don't know what the heck is.
Well, the problem, Jim, is you're about 10 years late on this revelation here. The reality is that NAFTA cannot be overturned by our Supreme Court.
Right.
That when the people of the United States got together and they passed laws, for example, saying that if tuna are harvested, are fished, that it has to be done in a way that doesn't kill dolphins. This was the result of 25 years of lobbying by the Humane Society, the United States of America, and other animal rights groups, and a broad public consensus, and we passed a law. Well, and then after we signed NAFTA, Mexico sued us and said, you can't have that law. You can't do that.
We had to say
to the Mexican fishermen, okay, because you can do it in Mexico, I guess we have to do it here. And our law got overturned by virtue of NAFTA.
Yeah, Tom, doesn't our Congress and Senate have two parliamentarians at all their meetings?
I don't know. I don't know
if they do, shouldn't our Constitution be held up right on the floor there? And if a senator or congressman goes against it, they get thrown out because of an oath?
Logic would kind of suggest that, Jim, but the way that we throw them out is called elections. I mean, that ultimately is where it works. And I think that that's, frankly, the best way for it to work. I don't think that we would want a bureaucrat bouncing out our elected officials. But we should be doing it. 27 minutes past the hour. Thanks, Jim.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I don't know, y'all. We're in a real deposition in the midst of all these negative conditions, divided by beliefs, differences in religion. Why did we keep missing the point on our mission? Why are we killing each other? What's the reason? God made us all equal in his vision. I wish that I could make music as a religion. Then we could harmonize together in this mission. Listen, I know it's really hard to make changes, but two of us can help and rearrange this, because you and lots of power and the voices. Together we will unite and make the right choice.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. In today's Wall Street Journal, over at thinkprogress.org, they note that Peter Wehner, Karl Rove's deputy, how do you pronounce that? W-E-H-N-E-R. Is that Wehner? Wehner? Peter Wehner. It's close enough. In today's Wall Street Journal, Peter Wehner, Karl Rove's deputy and the director of the White House's Office of Strategic Initiatives, writes an op-ed to try to debunk the anti-war myths, right? So, and the Wall Street Journal publishes it. Like, you know, gee, this is important information for America. No. And this, as said, I mean, they say it so well. This posting, Faiz posted this thing over at Think Progress. And it's just, he says it so well, I had to quote him. He says, the White House has been emailing the article to reporters this morning, employing the same tactic that led the nation into war. The White House continues to use the media to peddle false claims in the hopes they will be accepted. Now, I've got to tell you, there is just a massive amount of this stuff going on right now. I at the beginning of the program, shared with you I've gotten three emails now from the RNC this morning for talk show hosts to talk about how Democrats are responsible for the price of gas going up, how if Al Gore's vision of global warming is accepted by Americans, it's going to destroy the economy. How if Democrats are elected, it's going to mean the end of prosperity, that everybody's going to become unemployed. I mean, the talking points are just flying fast and furious, and that Jimmy Carter should be censured. That the Senate should censure Jimmy Carter. He dared, after all, to say that we should have 20% of our electricity coming from solar power by the year 2000. Can't have that. So this myth that the president misled Americans to convince them to go to war. See, what the Republicans are doing is they're basically taking all the areas where they're getting bad rap and they're flipping it around and trying to place the blame on Democrats or somewhere other than themselves. Whether it's the high price of gasoline, the fact that we have no national energy policy other than giving billions of dollars in tax breaks to big oil companies and building more highways for cars rather than building mass transit, whether it's the disaster that is the war in Iraq, whatever it may be, when the Republicans start taking a hit, what do? They come out and they lie about it and blame Democrats. And these lies are particularly egregious because these lies have led to the deaths of over 100,000 human beings, the vast majority of them people who had nothing to do with combat, the vast majority of them people who simply wanted to live their lives. To rebut this myth that the president misled Americans to convince them to go to war, Wiener states, or claims, quote, important assumptions, this is what Karl Rove's deputy and the director of the White House's Office of Strategic Initiatives, in other words, the official White House propaganda office, in today's Wall Street Journal, he says, important assumptions turned out wrong, but mistakenly relying on faulty intelligence is a world apart from lying about it. Now, I've only heard that about 100 million times in the media. Well, let's say a few thousand anyway. But here are the inconvenient facts, to borrow a phrase from Al Gore, as Faiz notes over at thinkprogress.org. While the Bushies are claiming in this editorial, in this op-ed in today's Wall Street Journal, important assumptions turned out wrong and that they were mistakenly relying on faulty intelligence, that in fact, is another lie. The fact is that the administration created stovepipes to feed politicized intelligence. In his nomination hearing last week, General Michael Hayden admitted that he wasn't comfortable with the administration's approach to Iraq intelligence. Hayden's comments reveal that intelligence experts like himself were sidelined in the run-up to the war, while political leaders like Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, and Doug Feith set up intelligence stovepipes to get the information they wanted directly to the top leadership. So, number one, they weren't relying on faulty intelligence. They were relying on lies. And beyond that, the administration had already determined that they were going to go to war, as we found out from the Downing Street memo. I mean, you know, as was proven by the Downing Street memo, as we found out by simply going back and reading George Bush's biography, written in 1999, or reading the Project for a New American Century in 1998, signed by Jeb Bush back when it was assumed that he was the one who was being groomed to be the next president. And the fact of the matter is, as Paul O'Neill, the former Secretary of the Treasury, the multimillionaire Republican Paul O'Neill, in his book on the topic says, you know, the day after they took the office, I mean, we're talking January of 2001, 9 months before 9/11, first order of business, how do we overthrow Saddam Hussein? Georgie wanted a war. He wanted a war so bad. He didn't want to fight one, but he wanted to send other people's children to fight in one. Because he knew, of course, that it would gain political capital for him, and, you know, political capital is pretty important stuff.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz,
says Cindy Sheehan before Congress,
then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
He's going to get everything passed he wants to get passed. That is rolling back the New Deal.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And wistfully, Cindy Sheehan adds a footnote that probably many parents are adding right now, certainly probably several thousand or close to it.
It looks like George Bush was ready to lead this country into an avoidable war even before he became president.
Yes. And she goes on to say, and it looks like my son was condemned before he even joined the military. Number two, that point number one in today's Wall Street Journal, in this lying op-ed that Peter Wiener, Karl Rove's deputy and the director of the White House's Office of Strategic Initiatives, put forward. The first lie is that important assumptions turned out wrong. No, sorry, it had nothing to do with that. This administration knew what the real intelligence was. The second lie that the Bush administration tells in the pages of the Wall Street Journal today in an op-ed. Quote, "The Bush administration pressured intelligence agencies to bias their judgments. This myth is shattered." That's the myth, right? "This myth," Wiener claims, Wenner, however you say it, "this myth is shattered by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence's bipartisan report on the U.S. intelligence community's pre-war intelligence assessments on Iraq." Say what? That's the Senate Intelligence Committee's investigation of what happened when, you know, the run-up to war. And the fact of the matter is that the first half, phase one of that investigation was, you know, where'd the information come from, how did it get there, all that kind of thing. Phase two is whether the Bush administration was pressuring intelligence agencies. Whether Cheney was showing up at the CIA every week. What was going on? Why were they doing this? That's phase two. Excuse me. And phase two has been blocked by Pat Roberts, the Republican chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He refuses to allow the completion of this report. In fact, what we know now is that back before we went into the war, the CIA was saying, there's nothing there. There's no there there. In 2003, in July of 2003, a CIA review panel found that agency analysts were subjected to steady and heavy requests from administration officials for evidence of links between Iraq and al-Qaeda, which created significant pressure on the intelligence community to find evidence that supported a connection. That's what the CIA discovered. This was a CIA review panel. Additionally, Wiener says Saddam was a threat, right? "While we did not find stockpiles of WMD in Iraq, what we did find was enough to alarm any sober-minded individual." Sorry, Charles Dulfer, the administration's own Iraq investigator, found no evidence that Saddam posed immediate threat. As Faiz notes over at thinkprogress.org, Dulfer, quote, "We found no evidence that he was passing to terrorist groups WMD material," end quote. Quote, "We found no evidence of an active nuclear weapons program, nor did we judge there was one," end quote. Quote, "It was my judgment that Iraq retained perhaps a strategic reserve, in other words, a deterrent, not an offensive capability," end quote. Lies in the Wall Street Journal by the administration. Will you hear them called on it tonight in the news? No. 45 minutes after the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. It's 9 minutes before the hour. Well, nine and a half. Tom Hartman here with you. The radio support group of By and For. We the people of the United States of America. Our telephone number, 866-440-THOM, 440-8466. Scott in Port Orchard, Washington. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I was listening to All Things Considered on 42106, and more or less characterized the casualties in the Iraq War as a tiny fraction of the casualties of Vietnam. And I mean,
well, they are.
Well, if you compare from the time that Vietnam started when we first had advisors there and the amount of casualties, I'm saying there's been more casualties in the first few years of this war than there were in the first few years of Vietnam.
Yeah, but you're not comparing apples to apples. We didn't do a wholesale immediate.
Well,
you
tell
Vietnam,
the families of the killed and wounded that it's a tiny fraction. I just think that's a very inappropriate term for an impartial journalist to make. And the other thing she said was she said that Jack Murtha's plan was for immediate withdrawal, which is a total, you know, Republican talking point. That's how she characterized it.
So you think that Mara Liasson is a stooge for the right? Is that the point you're making?
Well, all they have is what I heard you saying earlier about her comment about the Abramoff scandal, and then what I heard here.
She was the one, you know.
NPR disgusts me, Tom. I can barely listen to it, and I've been listening to it all my life.
Yeah, it's a sad thing, but you know, I know what you're saying, Scott. It's she was the one back in 2002, I believe it was, who was interviewing, Grover Norquist. And when he said that he didn't want to destroy American government, he merely wanted to shrink it down to the size where he could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub. So, Scott, thanks a lot for the call.
Can I make one more point, Tom?
Sure.
If you take the amount of American contractors killed and the amount of American soldiers killed and the amount of suicides of American soldiers, I believe that more Americans have died in Iraq than died on September 11th. Someone had to completely verify that. There's been like 400 contractors killed. And there's been a lot of suicides, more than any time in the history of the U.S. military in the last few years.
Yeah.
So I think that's something that needs to be looked at. More Americans have already died in Iraq than died in 9/11.
But see, that, you know, the problem with making that analogy, and I've debated whether or not to make that analogy on the air, is that it goes back, it reconflates Iraq and 9/11. And Iraq and 9/11 have nothing to do with each other. Bush had decided to invade Iraq before he was installed as president by the Supreme Court. He made no bones about it. His brother signed off on it. I mean, there was this whole bunch of them that they were going to invade Iraq, period. And so that happened. And, you know, 9/11 provided him with an excuse, and he used it well, but in fact, Bush himself has on various occasions, well, at least on one occasion, has come out and said that there's no relationship between the two. So,
but the problem is that
in fact here he is right here.
We have no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with September the 11th. Yeah.
We have no evidence, he says.
But Bush has killed more Americans than Osama bin Laden.
Well, using the word killed, I'd be very careful about that. But Bush has been responsible through his policies for the death of more Americans than Osama bin Laden. I would agree with that. I wouldn't, you know, and I don't think that his, I really don't believe, though. I mean, there's a real qualitative difference, and that is that Osama bin Laden, assuming that he actually was behind 9/11, that hasn't been demonstrated in a good investigation. I think it's probably a safe assumption, but I don't know. But assuming that that's the case, Osama bin Laden did that intending to kill Americans. I really don't believe that Bush invaded Iraq intending to kill Americans.
He knew there would be pawn sacrifices, Tom. I mean, soldiers are not pawns. My wife was sent to Iraq. They are not pawn sacrifices. You know, and he did it for money, and bin Laden did it for religious fanaticism. I mean, what's the difference?
Well, I maybe I'm cutting him too much slack, but I really think that Bush, at some level, believed that he was doing the right. Of course, I guess Osama bin Laden believed he was doing the right thing, too. Yeah, okay.
You know, these guys are straight out of George Orwell's Animal Farm.
I know.
The way they ran a 2004 election, John Kerry was Snowball.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and he also won the election. I mean, you know, that's a whole other.
Supposedly won it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks a lot, Scott. Yeah, no, I mean, Kerry won it. We just discovered in the last month or so here that Ken Blackwell bumped 300,000 people off the voting rolls in Ohio just before the election, most of them in districts that voted over 80% Democratic. And Bush won if, you know, 56,000 people had changed their votes. And that's what, you know, according to the voting machines, if 56,000 people had changed their votes, Bush would not be president right now. John Kerry would be. And, you know, Kerry knows that, I'm sure. So, anyway, what do you do with that? Where do you go with that? Well, I think it's time for a piggy's alert.
291 billion pounds, Dr. Calculus.
Well, let me see. That would be 145 million and a half tons of the,
refuse.
Yeah, refuse, per every day. And by the year, let me figure, over 53 million tons of,
From the Bush administration.
Yeah. By comparison, the pyramid of the Pharaoh Cheops weighs about 690 million tons, which means that every four and three, you've got a pile of this,
excrement.
Yeah.
Have you seen the bigger pigeons in the starched white shirt?
Look out for the ones in the starched white shirts.
Bigger pigeons stirring up the dirt. Always have clean shirts to play around.
Well, speaking of piggies and their starched white shirts, we raised the issue of Richard Pombo last week. We are working to get some of the Democrats who are talking about running against him on the air here. But, boy, it is mind-boggling when you look at what this guy has done. For example, just one example, misuse of his franking privileges. That's where you can sign a letter and send it without postage for free. 175,000 copies of a two-page leaflet that openly praised the House Resources Committee and the Bush administration for letting snowmobiles in national parks. Who did he send them to? Snowmobile owners. You look at the who's giving him money. I mean, this guy, he's raised at $1.4 million in 2005 to 2006. In just 1 year, a good chunk of it coming from the oil industries. It's incredible. Coming up tomorrow, David Tebow, conservative, going to be here telling us that 200 million more American or Mexicans are coming. When are these guys going to wake up? Unembedded journalist in Iraq, Aaron Glantz, is reporting on how America lost Iraq. Jeffrey Feldman, the frame shop is open, is dropping by with the frame. Sending the Boardroom Patrol, that and more in your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, the Democracy Zone. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.